Aurora had survived and was heading to America, but would she be free? And would people listen when she tried to tell her story? I'm Laurelee Siemens, and this is the Church History Podcast. Before we begin today's episode, I would like to address the families who listen together. I'm so thankful for my younger listeners, and I love the opportunity to share history with all of you. However, this episode contains deeply traumatic content. While I'm taking care not to be graphic in the storytelling, the events themselves are heartbreaking and could be difficult for some listeners, especially children. So parents, I encourage you to listen first and decide if your child is ready to hear this story. Use discretion and prepare your heart. This is a story of unimaginable loss, but also courage, survival, and faith. Also, this is part three in the story. If you haven't heard the first two episodes, I recommend listening to them first. Before we dive into today's story, I would like to remind you about the two books I have out, which tells the beginning of the church history. Here's a little advertisement for that.
My new book, The Church is Corrupt, is available for order. I previously published the book, The Church is Born, which was part one in our series, and that delved into the creation of the church. But my second book picks up where the first one left off. It offers a unique and insightful perspective on the church's journey. Discover the rich history of the church, its triumphs, its failures, and its heroes. In this second book in the series on church history, we journey through the pivotal moments that shaped Christianity as we know it. From the foundational theology of the early church to the inspiring lives of great men and women who boldly stood for their faith. Explore the church's role during the Crusades, the Inquisitions, and even the discovery of America. Learn how over centuries, the church began to slowly lose its way, setting the stage for the monumental changes just before the Protestant Reformation. With each chapter highlighting a different story, you're going to be inspired by the heroes of our faith and challenged to reflect on the lessons from the church's successes and its stumbles. Whether you're a seasoned historian or just beginning your exploration of church history, this book offers valuable insights for everyone. Both books, The Church is Born and The Church is Compromised, are available on Amazon for you to order. So if you haven't gotten the first book, why not get both today and delve into the comprehensive understanding of the church's journey?
Just 2 years earlier, Aurora had been a 14-year-old girl living a peaceful, privileged life in a respected Armenian Christian family. Her days had been filled with school lessons, family dinners, and quiet prayers. But when the Ottoman Empire turned on its Armenian citizens, her world had been torn apart. Her father and brother were taken and never returned. Her family were forced to march across the desert. One by one, she lost her siblings, her mother, her aunts, each ripped away by soldiers, disease, or the brutal reality of genocide. Aurora had been beaten, enslaved, sold, and sexually assaulted, but somehow, again and again, she escaped. She had found refuge with Kurdish families. She had joined hidden Armenian camps. She'd walked through wildernesses and war zones and eventually reached Russian territory. Along the way, she chose life. She chose faith. She chose never to bow to fear or to deny her God. And now, after all of that, she had a passport and a destination. She was going to America. Aurora had escaped one horror, only to find herself standing on the edge of another. She was in Russia, exhausted, recovering, finally surrounded by people who welcomed her. When the ground shifted again, the Bolshevik Revolution erupted, and with it came a new wave of violence, once again focused on the church. We did an episode, a few episodes actually, on the Bolshevik Revolution, and I'll put links to those in the show notes. The country she'd seen as a refuge was about to descend into a chaos of its own. The revolutionaries turned their fury towards the church. Priests were arrested, cathedrals desecrated, Bibles burned. It was a kind of new genocide, aimed at Christians and their faith. For Aurora, it was a cruel echo of what she had just survived. But before the rising tide could swallow her, the door had opened. American missionaries who had helped Armenian refugees arrange their passage across the Atlantic, and with their help and her uncle's determination, she boarded a ship, clutching a few documents, really the only belongings that she had. Exactly 2 years after the day she'd been forced to begin the death march, Aurora stepped onto American soil. She was 16 years old. When Aurora stepped off the ship in New York Harbor, the air felt sharp and clean, like the future was waiting just beyond the docks. She had no suitcase, no family waiting to greet her, no familiar voice calling her name. She was in a brand new country with a new language completely on her own. All she had were memories, scars, and a passion to tell her story. But she wasn't alone for long. In the swirl of languages and the noise of the city, an Armenian couple heard her story, and they took her in, not as a guest, but as a daughter. Their names have been lost to history, but to Aurora, they became something priceless, a new family. These were people who didn't ask her to forget where she came from, but promised to help her figure out where she was going, and they officially adopted her. In their small New York apartment, she found warmth and quiet and a place to rest, and with their help, she began searching. Her heart clung to one desperate hope, that her brother Vaughn, who had left for America before the genocide began, might be alive somewhere in this vast country. They placed ads in newspapers. They reached across states and cities, hoping that someone, anyone, might recognize his name or his face. But the letters never came. No response. Even as Aurora's name would soon be spoken across the country, even as she stood on stages and testified to crowds of thousands, she never found him. She never heard his voice again. And in time, she understood what that silence meant. He was gone. Another name added to the list of those the world had lost. Telling her story was agony. Telling it again and again and again felt like she was bleeding in public. After arriving in New York, Aurora's story began to attract attention. The New York Sun and New York Tribune published pieces about this teenage refugee who had escaped a genocide. Along the articles, they included heartfelt pleas to help try to find her brother. But the spotlight brought more than just sympathy. It brought responsibility. A writer named Henry Gates read her story and was moved. He and his wife, Eleanor, reached out and eventually became her legal guardians. They encouraged her to begin using a more Americanized version of her name. It was yet another shift in her identity, another adaptation in a life already reshaped by survival. Shortly after, Aurora was offered a place in a boarding school by a humanitarian group that had helped rescue her. When she was asked what she wanted to study, her answer was quick: music. She loved losing herself in melodies and instruments, and she really wanted to live like any other teenage girl. But she ended up declining going to the boarding school because she had a mission. She couldn't afford a luxury of a quiet life, not while her people were still suffering. Henry Gates set up a temporary headquarters for her in a hotel in New York. And there, just months after escaping the Ottoman captivity, Aurora began recounting her story. She spoke in Armenian, broken, halting. Translator scribbled furiously, and Henry edited. And together, they crafted the first full account of what she had endured. The process was grueling. Each day, Aurora was asked to reopen the wounds she really needed to close. One afternoon, in the middle of another brutal retelling, someone asked her a question. What hurt more, watching your own family be murdered or seeing your nation destroyed? She was quiet for a long time. Then she said, "They are the same." The words Aurora spoke in that hotel became more than memories. They became a movement. Henry Gates translated her grief into sentences, and editors began publishing her testimony. Her story took shape in the form of a book. In 1918, Ravished Armenia was released to the public. It was raw, devastating, and unforgettable. Although original copies are rare today, the book spread like wildfire when it was first published. In America alone, over 1 million copies were reportedly sold. In Britain, the 13th edition surpassed 350 copies. It was printed, reprinted, crossing oceans and borders. You could find it in bookstores, in homes, in South America, Argentina, Cuba, Mexico, and even Japan. Aurora's voice, once silenced in the deserts of the Ottoman Empire, was now being heard in languages she had never even spoken. While she had been adopted by this kind Armenian couple in New York, the reach of her story and the commitment required to tell it soon changed the course of her new life. Henry and Eleanor Gates became very invested in this mission and persuaded her adoptive parents to formalize the guardianship. Aurora was now legally in their care. They weren't there to protect a teenage girl, though. They wanted to become the messengers of her truth. It all started with a piece of paper. Aurora, still learning English, was handed a document by Henry and Eleanor Gates, who were now her legal guardians. These were the people she believed were helping share her story. They told her it was an agreement to take a picture. She thought it would be related to the book. She trusted them, and she signed. She was promised $15. She thought $15 to be in a picture, that seemed fair. But it wasn't about being in a photograph. It was a contract, a legally binding agreement, for Aurora to star in a full-length silent film called A Picture. She would play herself in a dramatization of her trauma. Ravished Armenia would not only be a book, it would now be a movie shown on screens nationwide. She had unknowingly agreed to relive her nightmare all over again in front of cameras, on cue, in costume. And for this, she'd be paid just $15 a week. The people who were supposed to protect her had taken her pain, packaged it for public consumption. She didn't even know she had the right to protest. She didn't even know what she had signed. By the time she realized what was happening, it was too late. And then, just before the cameras began to roll, Aurora fell gravely ill. She caught the Spanish flu. It was a deadly pandemic sweeping the globe. For weeks, she hovered between fever and delirium. And just as her body began to heal, the demands of production began. Aurora, still weak when filming started, there was no delay and no rest. During one of the early scenes, she broke her foot. And the very next day, she was scheduled to shoot the death march. The scenes of Armenians being driven across the desert. A cast was going to ruin the visuals, so the director insisted they cut it off. Aurora limped barefoot through the hot California sands, shot after shot, retaking her trauma again and again. She was sick, injured, and silenced. She had survived the desert once before, and now she was being forced to survive it again for the camera. Then came another insult. They had written a fictional love interest into the script, a boyfriend for Aurora. She was stunned. She told them she had no boyfriend. Conservative Armenian Christian girls didn't date. But the Hollywood producer dismissed her. "The audience will care about you more," he said, "if you're searching for a man." All her pain, all her faith, all her losses, that wasn't enough. Her story, they decided, needed romance. Every time Aurora protested, Henry and Eleanor Gates would remind her, "Your people need this film. You must keep going." Behind the scenes, no one asked her how she was doing. There was no therapy, no comfort, no help. She was a teenager reeling from a genocide, forced to act out her trauma in silence while the world watched. One of the most talked about scenes in the film would also become its most haunting. This scene showed a row of young girls dressed in simple garments, arms stretched out, fastened to wooden crosses. Imagery evoked deep spiritual symbolism, resembling the crucifixion of Christ. It was intended to represent the suffering of innocent Armenian girls at the hands of the Ottoman regime. But as the scene was being filmed, Aurora hesitated. She went to the producers and gently but firmly told them, "That is not what happened." She explained that during her forced march, she had passed through a village where young girls had been subjected to horrifying violence, much more severe, much more graphic. The crosses were real, but the suffering had been far more brutal than what was being shown on the set. When she was marched through that village, the teenage girls that she saw on the crosses had been stripped naked, raped, and then impaled on a large stick. And it was the impalement that they had been forced to sit on that had killed them. The producer listened, but refused to make a change. "That is too much," he said. "The audience would never handle it. Plus, the film wouldn't be allowed to be shown on the screen. And so the scene remained. It was powerful and symbolic, but ultimately a softened version of the truth. Ironically, it would be this fictionalized scene that shocked audiences the most. It's one of the few surviving fragments of ravished Armenia that still exists today. Yet the true story, the reality that Aurora had witnessed, was far more devastating. In 1919, Aurora's story reached the world. The film, Auctions of Souls, based on her memoir, Ravished Armenia, premiered in New York City. The event wasn't just a film screening, it was a major cultural moment. Ambassadors, state leaders, and military officials filled the theater. Their presence signaled something rare, official support for a film about a young refugee girl from a forgotten genocide. The production itself had been very quick, just 6 weeks of filming, but the impact was immediate and explosive, and within a month, the film was everywhere. In 1920, it ran 3 weeks at London's Royal Albert Hall, shown twice a day. It played across the United States, Argentina, Japan, and Australia. Wherever it went, audience left stunned. And it wasn't cheap. Tickets cost $10, which was an enormous sum at the time, equivalent to several hundred dollars in today's value. But despite the high price, crowds packed the theaters. The film broke records. Aurora had made a vow. She had promised, through her fear and her famine, through her captivity and escape, that if she survived, she would tell the world what had happened to her people. And she had done just that. As her image flickered on the screens from New York to Tokyo, she had kept her promise. But despite the film's fame, and soon her own fame, Aurora still felt utterly alone. She had no family, no childhood friends. The people who once surrounded her in love and safety were gone. Her life was a blur of theaters, interviews, and audiences hungry for her story. City after city, night after night, Aurora stood before packed crowds, reliving the darkest moments of her life. And remember, she was 16 years old. There was even talk of sending her to London for the 1920 British screening. She was barely past childhood, carrying open wounds of trauma, but promoters believed her presence would draw more attention. As many of the American showings, Aurora made personal appearances. In some cities, they held morning performances, screenings for women only, where Aurora shared more details about what Armenian women had endured through the abuse. The emotional cost was staggering. In May of 1920, Aurora made her final appearance in Buffalo, New York. As she finished speaking, she fainted. Her body, like her spirit, had given all that it could. After she fainted in Buffalo, it was clear Aurora had reached a breaking point. But rather than giving her time to heal or rest, Henry and Eleanor Gates sent her to a convent. It was meant to be quiet, secluded, and out of the public eye. But Aurora didn't feel safe, and she didn't feel free. And once again, she found herself needing to escape. Before she could disappear, the Gates made one final move. They hired 7 lookalikes, other young Armenian girls who kind of resembled Aurora. They would accompany the film and continue its tour, and they would tell the story as if they were her. There was no disclaimer and no explanation. To the public, they thought they were meeting the real Aurora. Even Near East Relief, which was the humanitarian charity using the film to raise funds for genocide survivors, was deceived. They too thought they were meeting the real Aurora. But Aurora watched from the shadows. Eventually, she had seen enough. She fled the convent, slipped through the gate, and made her way to New York, determined to reclaim her identity and her life. In New York, Aurora found someone who listened to her, a representative from Near East Relief, a woman who had become a dear friend to Aurora. She welcomed her with open arms, and when Aurora explained what had happened, the friend was stunned. She believed, like everyone else, that it was Aurora traveling city to city, giving heartfelt 10-minute presentations. The idea that 7 impersonators had been paraded around the country in her name without her knowledge or consent was shocking. This was the moment something shifted in Aurora. After years of being used, silenced, manipulated, She decided she was done. She said in her heart and with her actions, enough is enough. She filed a lawsuit against Henry and Eleanor Gates, who were her legal guardians. She hadn't even been paid what she'd been owed. The contract she had signed, unknowingly, was worth $7,000, a significant sum in those days. But what had they given her? $195. Aurora had become famous. She'd spoken before powerful people. She'd written a best-selling book. She'd survived one of the greatest tragedies of the 20th century. But what do you do with a life that's broken and rebuilt too many times? Many young men tried to court Aurora over the years. One historian even talks about a president's son asking Aurora to marry him. But the horror she'd endured left her uninterested in romantic affection. Still, she believed she had a duty, not to herself, but to her people. She felt it was her responsibility to marry an Armenian man and have children, to do her part in ensuring the survival of a people that had been erased from history. She eventually married a man named Martin, and together they had one son. But the trauma she carried, silent and suffocating, never left her. Every knock on the door sent her into a panic. Crowds terrified her. Even a quiet outing was too much. She lived in a constant state of fear. Martin tried to understand, but the weight of her past created tension in their home. Her son, American-born and raised, struggled the most. He just didn't understand why his mother was always afraid, why she refused to leave the house, why she couldn't be the mother he needed. When Martin passed away, Aurora's fear deepened, and the little safety she clung to slipped through her fingers. Her world became even smaller. She locked doors and she avoided everyone. She lived alone, isolated by both trauma and time. Eventually, age made it impossible to live alone. On January the 3rd, 1994, she was taken from her home and moved into the Ararat Nursing Facility in California's San Fernando Valley. No one even knew who she was, not the staff, not the hospital, not the residents. After all she had done to tell the world her story, she was now a forgotten old woman. And just 1 month after being admitted, Aurora passed away. She was 93 years old. No one came to claim her body. Her ashes were left uncollected, and she was buried in an anonymous grave. Her son had died by this time, and her grandson, who had never really known her, didn't even know what had happened. Today, her grandson is still alive. He owns a restaurant in Hawaii. And Aurora also has a great-granddaughter, described by some as having her beauty and charm. Her story nearly vanished from memory, but now it's being told again, because Aurora should never be forgotten. So here are some questions I had after researching her story. First, what happened to the film? For years, Auction of Souls had been shown around the world. It captivated audiences. It broke box office records and awakened a generation to the horrors of the Armenian genocide. But then it disappeared. During that time, films were made using nitrate film stock. It's a material known for being flammable and unstable. Fires broke out in projection rooms across the world. Some of them were deadly. As a result, it became a standard practice to dispose of a film after the theatrical run. No one really thought about preserving it. And Auctions of Souls had been so widely distributed with so many copies in circulation that no one believed it was necessary to save a copy. Everyone assumed someone else was doing that. But actually, no one did. Today, only an 18-minute fragment of the film survived. And that piece exists only because it was used in a later documentary about the Armenian genocide. The rest, almost 2 hours, has been lost. Still, some historian collections haven't given up hope. Auction of Souls remains one of the most sought-after lost films in cinema history. Everyone hopes that perhaps somewhere in an attic or a forgotten archive or a mislabeled reel, maybe it still exists, waiting to be found. The next question is, what happened to the Turks? In the years following the Armenian genocide, the Ottoman Empire, which was already weak, was devastated after World War I and completely collapsed. The Allies occupied Constantinople in 1918, and the empire's vast territories were divided up. Here is what happened. Iraq was given to the British Mandate. Syria became a French Mandate. Lebanon became a French Mandate. Palestine became a British mandate and was later returned to the Jewish people as the land of Israel. Jordan became a British mandate. Saudi Arabia gained full independence. Yemen, which was very heavily influenced by Ottoman, became an independent kingdom. Kuwait became a British protectorate. In North Africa, we have two countries. Egypt went under British control, and Libya became part of Italy. In Europe, Greece had already gained its independence in the 1800s, but the Ottomans officially lost any control during the Balkan Wars and World War I. Bulgaria got its independence. Serbia became independent. Romania became independent. Albania became independent. Bosnia became part of the Austria-Hungary, and Macedonia and Montenegro became part of what would later become Yugoslavia. Anatolia was the only part that the Turks remained, and that is today Turkey. What happened to Armenia? Well, today the Armenian people are still facing painful consequences of past and ongoing conflict. In 2023, Azerbaijan launched a final offensive, forcing 100,000 ethnic Armenians to flee to Armenia. This region's Armenian government dissolved shortly after, marking the end of decades-long struggle for autonomy. Armenia is currently overwhelmed with refugees and strained resources, and despite ongoing peace talks, border tensions and violence continue. Armenia is also undergoing political shifts, moving away from Russian influence and seeking closer ties with the West. Although peace agreements in draft do exist, there is so much mistrust that still remains, and also the trauma of displacement and loss continues to shape the Armenian identity today. Just like Aurora herself, left alone in her final years, her story fading from, so too has the Armenian genocide been forgotten by much of the world. It was one of the darkest chapters in our church's history, a time when Christians were targeted, uprooted, and slaughtered, and yet today few Christians even know about it. I was in grade 10 when Aurora died, alone in a nursing home, no headlines, no memorials, no recognition of the teenager who had once stood before world leaders and pleaded for justice. She came to America to tell the story of her people, and she did that. Now it's our turn. We can tell her story by forwarding this episode and the two before this. We can honor the vow she made as a young girl walking through the desert that the world would not forget. So please share this episode. Share parts 1 and 2. Tell somebody about Aurora. Let the church remember and let the world remember.
If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. We release new content every Monday. And don't forget to check out our website at loraleesiemens.com for more information and additional resources. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week as we continue our journey through the incredible history of the church.